Hello, everyone. I see it's 8:31, so I'm going to begin. And Rabbi Kelman is not with us, although he might join us in a little bit. The date is May 23rd, and I'm very happy again to be with you. This is class 16 in our continuing series. I'm not sure how much longer it'll go before we break for the summer, but certainly tonight and next week, and maybe even a few times in June. I want to, as always, pick up on a few things that were mentioned. I want to first thank Justin, who called my attention to something I didn't know. If you look online, I don't have my own copy of Otzer Dinim HaMinhagim. I have a copy, but not an original. I have a reprint. And even on HebrewBooks.org and Otzer Chachma, it's a reprint. But in the original publication of 2017, this is what appears, dedicated to a new Russia. This is, of course, before the, this is after the first revolution, not the communist revolution. I was happy to see this. Thank you, Justin, for sending it to me. I mention this because we spoke a good deal about Eisenstein, and I recently uncovered, I found in one of the old newspapers, a new picture of him. You can find pictures of him. If you just Google his name, you'll get pictures. But this is a nice picture of him looking straight. So thank you for that, Justin. I listened to the class last week, and I think I do need to clarify something, because we were talking about statements of Jesus. And I think I said that this could be, because Paul quoted a rabbi who actually cited similar to what Jesus said. So then we went off into a bit of a tangent about this. What I said is it's good Jewish teaching to say more important than what goes in the mouth is what comes out of the mouth. And Lashon Hara, if you embarrass someone, it's considered like you killed them. The rabbis tell us. So that's good Jewish teaching. The actual language of Jesus, however, I wouldn't say that that's good Jewish teaching, because here it says what goes into the mouth doesn't defile them. What comes out of the mouth, that's what defiles them. That implies that there's really no problem with the food you eat. The only important thing is what you say. And it's hard to understand, you know, did Jesus really say this? There's a whole discussion as to what Jesus said, or what he didn't say, because he does appear in other places as a halachic Jew, maybe cutting corners a little bit. But that statement that it's you're not defiled by what goes in the mouth is really very different than the statement of which I summarized it, which actually is incorrect, the way I summarized it, that more important than what goes in the mouth, which I will indeed affirm is good Jewish teaching, unlike what you see there from Jesus. I just want to refresh our memories. We had the little discussion of the NRA. I think it was, again, Justin who pointed out what this is. I guess I should have looked ahead of time. I didn't really pay attention to the NRA thing, but you can see on Wikipedia, here you have a nice article on the National Recovery Administration, and there you have the symbol. And finally, I just have one more thing, so not as in previous weeks where I have a lot to say. We saw this last class, the declaration of the rabbis, of the Agudas Rabbanim, against these liberal Orthodox rabbis that you can carry money with you on Shabbos because maybe you're going to be mugged and it could save your life. And I spoke about how, you know, maybe, well, why wouldn't you apply this then to carrying a gun? That's also muktzah. A few people mentioned, and I think it's correct, that it's not just the money being muktzah that's the issue here. It's the carrying on Shabbos. So you're going to say, so what's the big deal carrying on Shabbos? That's also Darbanan, carrying on Shabbos. But when you're dealing with Manhattan and you're dealing with Ramosha Feinstein, who signs it, you can assume that their opinion is, Ramosha's opinion is, that this is a real Rosh Hashanah. And therefore, I think the issue here is not just muktzah aspect, although that also might have been enough of a reason to say you can't do it. I mean, muktzah is derabanan. You can't just carry, you can't just violate a derabanan because of a far-fetched possibility. However, here it could be even more, that this is, I think what could be understood here is that this is carrying in Rishus HaRabim, which is an Isra D'Araisa, and you could say, wait a second, there is an Erev in Manhattan, the Manhattan Erev. Well, Rav Moshe didn't hold of that Erev. Not only didn't he hold of the Manhattan Erev that's been around for many, many decades, even, it was around even before this, he wouldn't hold of any of the Erev in like the West Side Erev, things like that. So I think that is probably correct, that the issue here is not just muktzah, but actual carrying in Rishus HaRabim. But it needs to be confirmed, maybe, what they would have thought about just violating a derabanan, because after all, it is a far-fetched case that you're going to be mugged, but it could happen. And if you're going to assume that you can carry money, then look, you can carry guns on Shabbos. People do it all the time. In Israel, they do it, and that's for pikuach nefesh. No one's carrying it, as far as I know, where there isn't an Erev, but when there is an Erev, then you can carry it. I don't even think though that's an issue. If you need it perhaps to save your life, then it's not even a muktzah issue anymore. I guess you can make the same argument on money as well. So I don't know. I'll leave it at that. Although if you recall, we spoke about Erev. This also relates to something someone asked me about. We talked a bit about what do you do if the Erev's down? What are you supposed to do? And I said that the tradition is, or the psak, that you don't make a public announcement, because then that'll lead people to violate Shabbos knowingly, when before it's unwitting. And that I think all rabbis know that. They might whisper to a few people who they know, let's say, brought their talis to shul, and therefore they'll leave it there. But if you know people are going to carry, you don't tell them. I should have mentioned, and in the discussion I had with someone online, I did mention, there is another position, which is generally not accepted, but it's worth mentioning because the person who holds this position is none other than Rav Shlomo Kluger. If you know about rabbinic Judaism in the 19th century, Rav Shlomo Kluger is not just a great rabbi, he's like one of the super great rabbis, Rav Brody, author of probably 100 Svarim. Really, look, 19th century was full of great rabbis, but he is even above many of these great rabbis. And what I'm going to tell you now, if you went to Yeshivat Har Etzion, we colloquially call Gush, this is well known because Rav Amital not only affirmed this, Halacha Lamaisa, he said that this is what they did in Europe. I don't know if that's true. I haven't been able to find anywhere. Look, he came from Europe, Rav Amital, but he was a young man when he left, maybe even a teenager. He was in Hungary. I have to check his dates, but he definitely was a young man. In fact, I could quickly just now check. Rav Amital was born in 24. Okay, so it doesn't have to be a teenager. Wasn't a teenager in the Holocaust, but definitely a young man. And I've never seen anyone else mention this, but he testified to it, at least in his part of the world. He's born in Romania, but that's really part of Hungary. People always say, I see online now, they always talk about that him as being from Hungary, but whatever. So what am I talking about? Rav Shlomo Kluger said, and he didn't just say it once, he said it in a number of tshuvot, that if the Erev is up at the beginning of Shabbos, we're not talking about the case I said where you find out, let's say, right before Shabbos, but it's the same issue. If, let's say, Shabbos already starts and then someone comes in and goes up to the rabbi and tells him he just walked by and he saw that the Erev's down, it would be the same issue. But Rav Shlomo Kluger says no. Rav Shlomo Kluger holds that if the Erev is up when Shabbos starts, then even if you know it comes down later, like even if the next morning, even if there's a storm, let's say, Friday night, and you're told the Erev is down, you can still carry on Shabbos. There's the principle of Kevan Shahutra, that it was permissible at the beginning of Shabbos. Now you're going to say, what do you mean? How is that permissible? It's permissible, but now it's not permissible. But I invite you to look at Rav Shlomo Kluger's tshuvot, and he holds that it's absolutely permissible to carry. I happen to see over Shabbos, I mean, I knew this sheet of Rav. Actually, I first learned about this through Rav Amital, not through Shlomo Kugler. And then I had to find it in Rav Shlomo Kugler. But this is famous for Rav Amital. But over Shabbos, I was reading this sefer. New, well, it's not so new. I think it's 2020 by Rabbi Chaim Jachter. Although I don't know if you could tell, the people checking the Erev are wearing masks. So the picture was during COVID. But this is all, he's an expert in Erevin, Rabbi Chaim Jachter. He from Teaneck. He's actually the rabbi of the conservative, the Sephardic shul in Teaneck. There's a Sephardic shul and he's an Ashkenazi. And he's the rabbi there. It's not the only example of Ashkenazic rabbis of Sephardic shuls, but he's written many volumes, and this is called Walking the Line, Hilchos Erevin, From the Sources to the Streets. He's a perfect example of a modern Orthodox posek. We have a number of modern Orthodox in America, halachic authorities. He is the advisor, the halachic advisor authority, I should say, of over 60 Erevin in America, as well as I know he's also in other places. So this is a very interesting book. He discusses, he gives examples. He even mentions my town, West Orange, one of the issues where he speaks about Teaneck and Stamford, Fort Lee, Allentown, different issues that came up, Inglewood, problems, Sharon, Massachusetts, different problems. And on page 236 and on, he discusses this for Shlomo Kugler. And he thought that maybe you can rely on him, at least as a sex sake, a double doubt. Like if there's a huge storm and there's a doubt if the air is intact, an additional doubt if Shlomo Kugler is correct. And he mentions that Rav Amital had told students, and I myself heard this, not from him personally, but by one of his students that he said this, that you can rely on Shlomo Kugler. But he quotes, and he went to the Har Etzion, Rabbi Jachter, he quotes Rav Lichtenstein, who was shocked to hear this because he did not believe that this was accepted. Rabbi Jachter actually says, despite his deep respect and love for Rav Amital, he finds the ruling untenable. And then he quotes Rav Hershel Schechter, who told him that you cannot rely on this leniency of Shlomo Kugler, even in a case of great need. So I guess it's an argument between Rav Amital and the others. Rav Amital, he quotes Rav Amital here, that as I mentioned, Rav Amital said that this the custom in Europe was to rely on this, and this is affirmed by his son Rav Yoel Amital, who's a Ram at Shalvin. So I've never heard of anyone really in practice relying on it in America, but it's an interesting view, and Rav Shlomo Kugler is hardly a small authority. Let us pick up where we are. We're in the middle, if you recall, dealing with Samuel Holtheim, really the first of the extreme, what we call the radical reformers. And he becomes known as an extreme reformer, as I mentioned last class, little tolerance for compromises. And I think the last thing I said was that his opponents regard him as an enemy of Judaism, but he sees himself as purifying Judaism. And in Michael Meyer's book on Holtheim, he sketches the development of his thought. And the way he understands it is at first he accepts, obviously first he's a pious Jew, the recipient of, we saw a tshuva from the Atar Tzvi, that's the author's name is Charlap, not one of the great poskim, but posek in the area where he was. How did I find this tshuva? I found it in Greenwald. Our friend Yusil Yehuda Greenwald from Columbus. He has a very nice book called The History of the Reformation in Hungary and Germany. And he was an expert in all the tshuvot. So in one of the notes, he cites this. He's the only one I've ever seen to mention this. And all the other discussions, they don't mention it. So in the beginning, he accepts everything. The Torah, the rabbis, he's a regular religious Jew. Later, and the Achronim as well. Later, he assumes the right to disagree with the more recent authorities, the Achronim. Later, he begins to distinguish, even from the Talmud, that certain things we can reject, others we don't reject, that if certain things are real traditions, Halacha Moshe Sinai, let's say, are real traditions they're preserving, and other things are just things that the rabbis came up with that we can reject. And he actually, at this point, still regarded the Midot Shatara Nidreshet Bahen, the hermeneutical rules, as having divine authority, so that he accepted. And but then the next step he rejects the Talmud in its entirety, including hermeneutical rules. And then his last step is going back to the Torah itself. Now, for a time, he thought that the Torah was actually divine revelation, and that couldn't be touched. Although even when he thought it was divine revelation, he still thought that the Torah itself lets you know that with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash and us being sent into exile, all the civil and ritual laws are no longer enforced. The only thing that's eternal are the religious and moral laws. But then later, he'll even distinguish between aspects of the Torah. What does it mean to be from God, the Torah? We'll see where he gets to at the end. But he has a very famous statement, which is often quoted, but most people, I think, don't know who they're quoting it. I've seen it attributed to Geiger. It's actually a whole time. And you can see, if you want to see it, the whole passage translated to English in Plaut's book on Reform Judaism, page 123, he says as follows. The Talmud speaks with the ideology of its own time, and for that age it was right. I speak from the higher ideology of my time, and for this age, I am right. In other words, what he says is the Talmud is right for its time. It's a different era. The people were at a different cultural level. They're surrounded by barbaric cultures. However, I'm right for my era. That is, I'm not arguing with the Talmud. The Talmud is speaking in one era, and it's right for then. Today, I'm speaking for our era, and I'm right for us. He has another long excerpt which really sets forth his ideas. In fact, I don't really read passages here. I don't like to do that, but let me find this passage because I think it's worth reading this one passage with us. Let's see here. Because it really sets forth, this is from Plaut's book. And just pay attention to this, because this sets forth his ideology very clearly. A large part of the ceremonial law exists because of the sacred nature of the Jewish people. The very essence of our people's holiness is the separation and election of this people from all other peoples and custom and habit, so that it might be a monotheistic nation devoted to service of God. In other words, we're chosen as a monotheistic nation, and we're special. Hence, Holdheim says, holiness expresses itself almost exclusively, with the exception of the eternally and generally valid moral laws and laws of separation. That is, kashrus, separated, all sorts of things that we divide ourselves from the non-Jews. How often is the Jew told, you must not do this or that in the same manner of other peoples, for you are a holy people until the eternal your God? We still hear this today. We're told that the Jewish people have a special role. We can't do that. That's what the non-Jews do. He continues, if one searches after the reason for most of the ceremonial laws of the Bible, one will find that they were given only because of the existence of pagan peoples. And how does their purpose separation from these peoples? Now, that's what he assumes. And he has good authority. That's what the Rambam says. The Rambam, all these things, even things like shatness, it's all to keep us away from the practices of the pagans, because they would do this, the pagan priests would do this. But the Torah itself doesn't say this, and the Gemara doesn't say this. This is the Rambam's approach. There's no reason to be bound to that. That already Rav Shamsher Raval Hirsch and others criticize the Rambam for the way they look at the commandments. In fact, Hirsch thinks that this gives strength to the reformers, because if these are reasons for the commandments, this is where you're going to let you. Just like Holdheim, he says, we must admit, therefore, that these laws would either not have been given at all or would have been given differently had the Jewish people been the only people in the world and had other people or human beings not existed at all. So he says, since all these ritual laws are there to keep us away from the non-Jews and their immoralities, had the Jewish people been the only people in the world, or had they been the only people, then these wouldn't have been commanded. There wouldn't have been these commandments, the reasons of which are to keep us away from the non-Jews, because there aren't non-Jews in the world. There is only one reason, he says, for Israel's ceremonial law, and that is the holiness of the Jewish people in relation to other peoples. That is its choice from amongst these other nations. That is, the point of this is to make us a holy people, a special people, in contrast to the other nations. But if the other nations didn't exist, we wouldn't need for this. Then he says, this may be compared with the holiness of the priestly tribe, that is the Kohanim. The Kohanim, it's the election from all the tribes of Israel for a specially sacred service, is the reason for their respective priestly laws. We have all the laws about the Kohanim because they're separate. But if no special tribe had been chosen, that is, if every tribe could do the, then there would be no priestly law. Similarly, he says, had the Jewish people not been chosen from amongst all other nations, had all of mankind been called for the purpose to which Israel alone was called, there would be no special ceremonial law. But rather would be there would be a law for all mankind, a simple, pure, moral law. Okay, so that's his starting point. Then he says, only because so many nations, indeed all men, were so little developed, and because Israel, in accordance with the promise made to our forefathers, had alone been called a holy people, was a ceremonial law necessary. For it was not sufficient for Israel to be given a moral law consisting of pure faith and true conceptions of the one true God. It had to receive the ceremonial law in the whole context of other peoples and Israel's relation to them. That is, because of the situation that ancient Israel was in, it needed the ceremonial law to affirm their uniqueness, their separateness, their holiness. It wasn't enough just to have the moral law. And then he continues, should all other nations perish from the face of the earth because of a flood and Israel alone remain, or should the rest of mankind accept the faith of the patriarchs and be converted to pure monotheism, in that very moment, the ceremonial law would cease to have binding force for Israel also. What he's saying is that if you can imagine a time where everyone would disappear, or, and this is the important thing, the rest of society would adopt monotheism, then the ceremonial law is no longer binding. For then the condition for this law, namely Israel's relationship to pagan peoples, would have ceased, and this law would sink into complete insignificance. And as Holtheim and others will then explain, we are now living in such an era. We are living in Germany. We're living in Europe where everyone is a monotheist. And in the Arab world, they're also monotheists. So all these special laws that are designed to keep us separate from the non-Jews are no longer applicable because they are no longer barbarians and they're no longer polytheists. They're not pagans. They're not idolaters. They're monotheists, even though they have a different perspective on it. They're monotheists. And then if you would say to them, well, what about the people living in these islands? That's not relevant. We don't live among them. The people we live among are monotheists, they're moral people, and therefore we don't need to be separated from them through the ceremonial law. The only thing that's binding is the moral law. And for, according to Holtheim, this is the intention of the Torah. At least he says so. It's hard to know whether he actually meant this, whether he actually believed this. But this is the reformers in the early generation will all, not only will they try to hold the mantle of Torah, but they're going to claim the mantle of Pharisees. That if the rabbis were around today, they too would have this perspective. But here you just saw it, that the mitzvos, most of the mitzvos, anything that's at all ritual has been completely jettisoned by Holtheim. And it didn't take generations. This just took maybe like 10 years before he came to this. So then where's their authority for anything if it's not in the law? Well, there is a law, but it's only the moral law. And there's going to be conscience. Conscience is going to be very important. Later, he'll come to the conclusion that the Torah itself is not really divine in the way he used to think of it, but it's the human reaching out for God, that God has given us a conscience, God has given us an intellect, and the religious authorities, the ones who are immersed in this, they are the ones to determine what is appropriate. And authority is not, you're not going to find it in texts, even in the Torah. It's really in reason, it's in your conscience, because even things in the Torah itself, our reason and our conscience is going to tell us when it's binding and when it's not binding. Even things that you might think are moral, we have to determine if they're moral or not. After all, last generation, two generations ago, certain sexual things were thought to be basic moral values, and now we're told otherwise. So even morality has to depend on the religious leadership, which has to be guided by its conscience. That's Holtheim's position. His problem was that he couldn't convince his reform colleagues to abandon the Talmud, because no one wants to be a carrot. there's trends in early reform very similar to Cartwright. Petachowski has an article, I forget the exact title, but something like Cartwright Trends in Early Reform, because you have all these reformers. Holtheim's a big one, but you have smaller ones who basically want to jettison the oral law, the Talmud. But most reformers are like, why is that better? We're not Cartwrights. We're part of a tradition. And their approach is going to be that, just like with the Torah, we take certain things and we don't take everything. If it doesn't fit in with our values, our era, so too with the Talmud. We're not going to get rid of the entire Talmud. That's the accumulated wisdom of all the sages. And there's all sorts of great stuff in the Talmud. So the typical reform response to Holtheim was that, no, we need continuity with the past. And they would throw out whatever they didn't want. But for Holtheim, this one fought. He wanted to completely get rid of the Talmud, and perhaps because he was such a Talmudist, and he was a Talmud Chacham, that when he, to use the modern phrase, went off the derech, he wanted to jettison everything and completely recreate Judaism. But Holtheim made a number of points. So, for example, he called attention to marriage and divorce. If you look at marriage and divorce in a halachic sense, the woman is clearly not equal, or equal in quotes, to the man, if by equal you mean that the woman could get divorced just as easily as the man. We all know that. We understand there's something called an aguna, which only applies for the woman, and that's the system as it was created. According to Holtheim, the only honest thing to do in modern times is to take this halacha — it's not just a halacha — and we take this mitzvah from the Torah in its entirety, that is, everything to do with marriage and divorce, and give it to the state. This is exactly what the Protestants did. Catholics always had religious marriage, and they don't have divorce. They don't believe in divorce, although you can get an annulment today and then if you had connections. But Protestantism always had religious marriage. But when it came to divorce, that was left to the authority of the state. And Holtheim said that is the same thing that we need to do, that marriage and divorce should go to the state. Religion, that is, the rabbi, can lend sanctity to the marriage, but the actual marriage, the event that creates the marriage, that is carried out by the state. And we are there as rabbis to talk about the holiness in marriage and the need to be faithful and all that. But it is given over entirely to the state, and just like no different than Protestantism. So should anything be preserved then religiously in terms of ceremonies, or is it all about morality and ethics? Well, he thought that if you can find customs, because everything's a custom now Holtheim, there's no law, it's all custom. And that, by the way, continues to this day in Reform Judaism. Everything's a custom. But if you do find elements of the old law, which raise your religious consciousness, which connect you to holiness, then you can preserve it, not as a law, but as a nice practice. I mean, ceremonies are irrelevant, but if you find something in a ceremony, and it has to be left to individual conscience. So, for example, if lighting the Sabbath candles gets you in the spirit of the Sabbath, and we'll see what the Sabbath means for him, very different than what it means for us, then you can do that, and there's nothing wrong with it. Then it's, or if you want to recite a prayer, I mean, all these things are left to the individual if they, as a custom, if they edify, bring edification. But there's no moral law, and ceremonies as a whole, he thinks, because he doesn't see value in them, should, for the most part, be seen as irrelevant and have no significance anymore. And he even cites there are a number of strange rabbinic passages that speak about in the Messianic era, the law will be abolished. If you look in my book, Changing the Immutable, I cite a number of them because it seems to contradict the Rambam's ninth principle that the Torah is eternal, and the rabbis have all ways of so that it doesn't contradict the Rambam's principle. They often say that the law was given originally not to be eternal, but the Rambam holds that the law by definition is eternal. But you have these passages even in on Pesach, we say it, right? Are we going to remember the Exodus, even in the days of the Messiah? But you have strange passages that there's even an apocryphal passage which doesn't exist in any source, but that the why is it called Chazer, a pig? Because in the future it will return to be, it will become kosher. And what the whole time says is that here you see that already the rabbis imagine that in the messianic or the future, especially the messianic era, Atid. Some people assume this refers to the ones who take it literally. Others don't take it literally, but the ones who take it literally often speak in terms of the after the resurrection. It'll be a different world then. But the whole time says that we see that the rabbis imagined the future era when the law would not be binding, and we are now in that era. We're in that, and the most important thing, and what's the most important thing for religion today? It's not deeds, not actions, but not deed, but creed, I guess you could say, but beliefs, but more than beliefs, sentiments, moral commitments. It's worth noting that, although Holtheim is not the only one to say this, this is going to become a standard reform approach, although Holtheim is more extreme in his rejection of ceremonies, but this remains to this day really the reform approach. We'll see how reform changes. They do change in certain areas, but this remains pretty standard. Well, once you adopt this position of whole time, then really, if you take, let's say, a Unitarianism or what you can call perhaps undogmatic Christianity, is there really anything different between that and Judaism, whole time's Judaism? I mean, if you remove Jesus as a God, and say as a moral guide or something like that, like the Unitarians would say, or Christians who really were not dogmatic, then Judaism without legal elements is basically the same thing as this form of undogmatic Christianity. And not surprisingly, that after civil marriage was permitted in Germany, Holtheim said that he would give his rabbinic sanction to wedding ceremonies between Jews and Christians, because what's Jews and Christians are both moral people. They worship the same God, and even Christians, real Christians, he would think this is an error, belief in Jesus. But fine, it's an error, but fundamentally, we have the same moral values. Holtheim is the first reformer. I think he's, the Horn also, Horn's later though. Holtheim said it even before Horn comes around to this, who said that intermarriage would be, he supports intermarriage, that you can give rabbinic sanction to intermarriage. And let me read you a text here that sounds like it could have been written in our multicultural era. After speaking about intermarriage, Holtheim justifies position by saying that the ancient prohibition on intermarriage refers to foreign peoples, other nations, not religions. And we're all Germans here. And therefore, the fact that someone worships a different religion, no, they're not what the Torah had in mind when it condemns intermarriage. It refers to other nations, and it refers to other nations who are barbaric. It has nothing to do with other religions. And we are all of the same nation now. Well, we're all Germans. We are German. We're Jews, but we're still part of this Germanic people. We become joined with them. And therefore, there is no problem with intermarriage. And according to Holtheim, what's most important is to speak of, quote, the holy God and father of humanity, not the holy God of Israel. That is, now we are to remove, he says, the phrase holy God of Israel, and in its place, holy God and father of humanity. We used to speak about, Holtheim says, quote, the covenant between God and Israel. Now we speak, he says, the covenant between God and humanity. We used to speak about the holy people of Israel. Now we speak about the holy human race. So everything is universalized. And that's his approach. And the fact that the ceremonies don't have the rituals, you know, taking a lulav or, you know, eating matzah, getting rid of chametz. Well, maybe matzah, you can eat matzah as like a symbolic thing about freedom. Well, there's plenty of Jews today. Their Seder tables are full of chametz, but they'll eat matzah. But I mean, getting rid of chametz and fasting and all the rituals, you know, observance of Shabbos, these are things that God does not want us to do today. And you want to know how he says we know God doesn't want us to do it today? Because it doesn't speak to us. Just look around. It doesn't speak to people. The rituals do not correspond to the spirit of the age. And that is God's way of speaking to us. This is a self-fulfilling prophecy. The fact that we don't find meaning in the law, that must mean that God doesn't find meaning. I mean, with this type of logic, you know, if I feel like I want to steal from my neighbor, that must mean it's permissible because the law about Geneva doesn't apply to me. It doesn't speak to me. But that's what Holtheim says. And it's I'm mocking it a little. But he's right in the sense that if you looked around, the typical modern Jew in Germany didn't feel like these commandments had any meaning. So therefore, that must mean that God's way of speaking. The jump he makes, though, is this idea that because the majority of people assume something, and remember, these are the people who don't have any connection to the religion, and they're feeling that way. So it's hard to see them as the judge. We'll see later when we get to Zacharia Frankel and the whole idea of Catholic Israel, which is people identify it with Salma Schachter, but it's really Zacharia Frankel spoke about it, based on good rabbinic sources. What Frankel said is that when you want to look at a practice and see if it's no longer binding because the people don't do it, you can't look at the people who are irreligious. They don't count. You have to look at the people who are actually religious and who are committed to the law and sacrifice for the law. If for some reason they stop doing the practice, well, then that could be God speaking to us that the practice is not really for our age. But the people, you can't look at people who don't observe anything because what does that tell us? That they don't observe. So they're not the holy people. That's pretty obvious, I think. Well, as I said, though, Holtheim was willing to acknowledge that certain ceremonies and certain practices could have value, and he therefore used the tradition in whenever he wanted to, in a selective way. And you could rework the rituals. So, for instance, the holidays. Holidays are a beautiful thing, but not the way we usually think of holidays. Holidays are beautiful because the idea of the holiday. What does it mean, the Passover, that God redeems people when they're in distress? It doesn't mean you have to sit at a Seder and eat four cups. And if you sit at the Seder, it's not the halachic Seder we think of, or the Shabbos. Shabbos is important, Holtheim says, but not Shabbos like we think of 39 melachos and special prayers and all the things, shamor v'zachor. That's not what's important. What's important is the idea of the Sabbath, the idea of a day that you need to rest and recuperate and recognize that life is not just about work. Life is also about reflection. And, you know, a day that you can, instead of working, you can study and you can spend time with family. But just like the secularists in Israel, they appreciate the Shabbat, but it's a different type of Shabbat than we think of. But because it's not about Shabbat in the halachic traditional sense, it's the idea of the Shabbos, Holtheim was very comfortable saying that we could change the Shabbos to Sunday. And that's actually a good thing because then we're in line with our neighbors. They're celebrating their Sabbath on the Sunday, and therefore we're going to celebrate our Sabbath also on the Sunday because it's not about the day, it's about the idea. Now, only some very radical reformers followed in this path, and although it did make it to America, and we spoke about this in a previous class, I think even in Chicago until not that long ago, there still was a synagogue who had the Sunday Sabbath, but this was something that really... It's hard to see I've had Jewish pride change it to the Sunday, but there were people who thought that, hey, look, it makes life easier because you're off, everyone's off. People often work in those days on Saturday, so make it on Sunday. And the values are the same. The value of the Sabbath that it instills in you these meanings that Holtheim waxes eloquent about. It doesn't really matter whether it's on Saturday or Sunday. It could be on Monday. It could be on Friday. Whenever you want to make it. Incidentally, since I just say Friday, you know, I think in the Muslim world, a lot of people make a mistake. The Muslims don't have a Sabbath. There's no, you'll see online and other, only online. I've never seen it in a book. They'll speak about the Muslim Sabbath is on Friday. There is no Muslim Sabbath. Sabbath means rest, a day of rest. The Muslims don't have a day of rest. Friday is a day of gathering where you're supposed to go to the mosque. Even if you don't go during the week, you're supposed to go there. But there's no concept of a day of rest for the Muslims. So that's the Sabbath. But for other things, Holtheim didn't see any need for externals. He did the shofar, the lulav. He wasn't attracted to these things. And Hebrew. This is going to become a big debate in the reform movement. What's the point of this language, this ancient language? He didn't see any value of it at all. But you do have to admire, I think, in one sense, whole time. You can look at him and see him as an assimilationist. He's tearing down everything. But he's, and obviously Jewish law has no validity for him and it has to give way to the law of the state. But he wasn't willing to give up the Jewish religion, at least in his understanding of it. He says religion is necessary and Judaism has something to give to the world. Now, obviously for him, Judaism is not halakha, but there is something special about Judaism. So he's not an assimilationist. He's not one of these people who just, as so many did, and including people from many in the reform movement, the second generation, third generation, who just decided to assimilate because this idea didn't really have much of a grab on them. But he, for all the strength that he speaks against traditional Judaism, he also speaks very positively about Judaism, that is his reconstructed Judaism. And we have to look at him as an important, even though most of his ideas were not adopted, he was one of the early reform leaders and was a model for what would become radical reform, which did not become mainstream reform, but he did have an influence. One who had a much greater influence was the next figure we'll look at, and who also could be radical in certain areas, but not like him, and that's Abraham Geiger. Abraham Geiger, born in 1810, receives a traditional Jewish education. He's from Frankfurt. That's where he's born. And his family is actually a very important family there, a very Orthodox family, so Orthodox that he was not even given a secular education in his youth. His maternal grandfather was a close student of Rav Nosson Adler, the famous Rav Nosson Adler. And Geiger's brother was a recognized Talmud Chacham. He wrote this book. Oops, sorry. Divrei Kehilot. This is Zalman Geiger, the brother of Abraham Geiger. It's Minhagei Tefilos of all the Minhagim. And it's a long book, almost 500 pages with his notes and discussion, all the Minhagim of Frankfurt. And he throws in the other Kehilos that follow after Frankfurt. Very important book, published in 1862. I see over here it says 1868. That's wrong, because you see right here, Bishnat Birchot, that's 1862. And this is a standard book. Anyone who wants to know Minhagim of Frankfurt, you have to look at it. I was looking at it. I was skimming through it earlier today. I'll show you what I found. Some interesting things here. Minhagim of Frankfurt. And that's the Kehila that he's on page, page 46. He says in the note that, I want to go back to page 60 first. Look at page 60 here. In the note here, he says, in Frankfurt, note two, they don't say the psukim that others kilos say that most of us do when we take a Torah out of the ark. We don't say Ein Kamocha in Frankfurt. We don't say Shema Yisrael, and not other psukim. And then he says, also Brich Shmei Ein Omrim beFrankfurt. You don't say Brich Shmei in Frankfurt. Why? Because it comes from the Zohar, and Chachmei Frankfurt, the sages of Frankfurt, refuse to accept Kabbalah. What he means there is refuse to accept Kabbalah in the davening, added to it. And Naftali sent me the Minhagim today of the Breuers community, and that I saw right before that I looked, that it says that they also do not say, I think it says though, except in Yomi Narayim, but they also don't say Brich Shmei in the London Minhag. If you look in the Minhag of the Chief Rabbinate of England, the old singer sitter, I don't have a sax sitter in England. I assume it's not in the sax sitter also that they use in England, although it is in the American version. They also did not say Brich Shmei. And I checked. I have a sitter here. This is Sitter Tefilas Yeshurun. This is from Vienna, which follows the Minhag of the old German Minhag, because the Frankfurt Minhag is the old German Minhag, and it does include Shema Yisrael, but it says only in a few. Ketzas Kiwas Ashkenaz, you say this. And it doesn't have a Brich Shemei at all here. It just says Vayehi ben Soa, no Brich Shemei. So I thought that was interesting. He then says, let me show you another passage I found. And this is the community that Geiger grew up in. On page 46, he says, this, I'd like to know some explanation of this. You can read, continue in his notes, but he says that Minhag Frankfurt is that you don't wear a tallis until you marry, you get married. Now, everyone assumes that the German Minhag is that you do wear a tallis when you're bar mitzvah. And I believe Naftali or others who are there, you can tell me in Washington Heights, don't the young men, when they become bar mitzvah, start wearing a tallis immediately?
Okay.
You wear it even when you're younger.
Yes. Even younger.
But that's not the original Minhag Frankfurt. And then he says, what do they do instead? They wear a tallis katan. And that's what they wear. And hold on, I printed it out here. And then he goes on that. He says that he quotes the Maharil here that. He says, I was a young man and I married a divorcee and then I made a special tallis for my marriage and I wear it. I had been accustomed in other places to wear tzitzis from the day he became bar mitzvah, but not in the land of my birth in the Rhine. Where in the Rhine region, he says that also Narim Gedolim, that is, you could be 17, 18 years old, do not, he says, Misatrim Betzitzis, that means a Taoist, until they get married. And he says they make a little drusha there. It says, Gedilim Tasalach, you wear Tzitzis. And right after that, it says, Kikachichi Shesha, when you get married. So that's where they base the Minhag on. And, then he goes on, he says that in the Rhine Minhag, even on Yom Tov, you won't wear a tallis. And he says that's hefek, that's opposite of Minhag Frankfurt, that on Yom Tov, you would wear it from 13 years. But other than Yom Tov, you wouldn't wear it. So that's, I don't know if anyone does that where they would just wear it on Yom Tov, not on Shabbos, and certainly not during the week. I found another interesting passage. Again, I'm sure there's lots of interesting ones. I know that Rabbi Hamburger cites this a lot, but I was just skimming through it. On page 196, he mentions, he says, 195, he says that about, what do you say when someone, let's say, gets an aliyah? Well, the words there, looks like Yashakoach, right? But he says that everyone makes a mistake. And the proper way to pronounce it is not Yashakoach or Yashar Kochacha. Certainly it's not Koach, but it's not Yashar Kochacha. What it is a Yishar Kochacha. And he cites the Gemara, and I see that Koren gets it right. This is in Shabbos 87a. This is where the expression comes from. Reish Lakish says, and it appears other places, the Gemara, Yishar kochacha shishibarta. May your strength be true because you broke the tablets. But this is where it comes from. In other places, yishar kochacha. So it's not yashakoach. It's not yesh. And then he goes on. Interestingly, he says that. So what do you answer? What do you answer when someone says shkayach to you, as they say in Eishel, over here? He doesn't say Baruch Tiyah, which, incidentally, growing up, I never heard this expression, Baruch Tiyah. It must have come from Israel. Someone says, Shkoyach, you say thank you, or you don't say anything. He says that what you should say is, because what did you say? If you say Shalom Aleichem, we reply, Aleichem Shalom back. So if someone says to you, Yishar Kochacha, you answer, Kochacha Yishar. That's what you're supposed to answer. And he cites a proof from this, but I don't know if that's his opinion of what you should say. He's not saying that that's the minhag. Anyone does say that. So that's Geiger's brother, a very important person, and remains a stalwart member of the community. And as I said, that's the classic work of Minhagi Frankfurt. However, Geiger followed a different path. Although he was not given an education when he was young, a secular education, he wanted one, and he ends up going to the University of Bonn, where none other than Shamshon Raphael Hirsch is also studying at the University of Bonn at the same time, and they even studied Talmud together. They had a chavrusa together for a short period. Hirsch does not remain there. Hirsch leaves. In Eastern Europe, they have this mistaken conception that Hirsch had a doctorate. Many call him Dr. Hirsch, but he did not have a doctorate. He left. And Rav Yaakov Ettlinger also did not have a doctorate, as Yehuda Hildesheimer did, and Rav Nosson Adler, not the Rav Nosson Adler from Frankfurt, Rav Nosson Adler, who becomes chief rabbi of England. He had, I think, the first doctorate. While at the university in Bonn, Geiger obviously expands himself greatly in languages and history and all sorts of things. And he writes a doctoral dissertation. The doctoral dissertation he writes, which if I'm not mistaken, was translated into English, although I'm not certain about this, it's called What Did Muhammad Take from the Jews? And it's a study of, sorry, he knew Arabic. It's a study of Jewish influences on Islamic teaching. So we all know that various prayers and they used to face Jerusalem before they faced Mecca, and the things that they don't eat. There's all sorts of other things. The Quran even mentions Abraham destroying the idols of his father. But Abraham Katz, who the son of Rav Reuven Katz, the Degel Reuven, the Petah Tikva, was at NYU. He wrote a very similar work, Jewish Influences on the Hadith. So you see Abraham Geiger, a very wide-ranging knowledge. So he is a great scholar. And he's also, I hate to say it, but it's true. He's a great Talmud Chacham. I mean, it's sometimes you read what he writes, and it's just, you have to stand in awe of how much he knew. I stand in awe of all these people, by the way, because today we have the internet, and before the internet, we have encyclopedias, and we have all sorts of these. You take a guy like Ginsberg. He writes The Legends of the Jews, in which he's taking all the Midrashim all over and putting it together. He didn't have any. He had to. If I want to know Midrashim, I open up the book and I see it. I open up Kashrus Torah Shlema. These are people who did it all on their own. They had it. They didn't have the concordances, and they didn't have the various works. They did it all themselves. So the Bekiyut of these people is real Bekiyut. That is, they have it at their fingertips. And Reifman, and I can go through so many of these. It's really incredible. But and Geiger was one of these types, but he didn't want to be an ivory tower philosopher. He wanted to have an active role in Jewish life. And already in his early years, we begin to see untraditional ideas of his. I can't tell you when he stopped observing Shabbos and when he would be regarded as not halachically observant. That I don't know. But we see unusual, maybe radical ideas already in his 20s. So, for instance, in 1836, when I believe that he was 26 years old. Yes, 26 years old. I just checked it in 1836. So that's when it was published. So it was probably written a couple of years before. He publishes an essay on the Mishnah, in which he attempts to interpret it differently than the Talmud interprets it. Those of us who study Talmud, you know, you read a Mishnah, and then you have a discussion. And often there's the Gemara wants to know, well, what's the Mishnah referring to? Because there's a contradiction. We have a Bryce that says something, so then the Gemara will tell us that, well, the Mishnah is referring to, it's not referring to that case, it's referring to this case. And so that the Gemara will clarify what the Mishnah is saying. Well, Geiger said, wait a second. Who said the Gemara is right? I'm going to interpret various Mishnayot at odds with what the Talmud says, what I think is the pshat, what the Mishnah really means. And he wrote an essay on this. And I think if he told the average person this, they would think that's heresy, it's kafira, it's radical, this and that. And there have been people who thought that. But This alone is not enough to make you a reformer. It's not enough to make you michutz l'machaneh. None other than the Rambam offers interpretations of the Mishnah at odds with the Gemara. And others do it as well. And if you want to see a justification for it, I'm going to show you something now. You can share this over Shabbos with someone if you're inclined. The Tosfos Yom Tov, Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller of Prague, Vienna, one of the greatest of the authorities, in Tractate Nazir, Perek Hay, I believe this is Mishnah Hay, after giving an explanation of the Mishnah, he says as follows. This is a fifth line from the bottom of the big lines, last words. He says, Afal Pisha Gemara Lo Pirshu Kein. Even though the Gemara doesn't give this explanation. In other words, he's supposed to explain the Mishnah. And he explains the Mishnah, but this is different than the Gemara. That's, I think some people would say, wait a second, if he's explaining different than the Gemara, I want my money back. Because the whole job of the Bartanura and the Tosfos Yom Tov is to give us a shortcut if we don't go through the Gemara to explain the Mishnah. He gives a different explanation. He says, Afal Pisha Gemara Lo Pirshu Kein. Even though the Gemara doesn't explain this, since this has no practical implication, as the halacha doesn't change, there's no practical implications. Harashus Natuna Lefaresh, the Sunna Lefaresh. Permission is given to explain. In other words, I'm going to give you an explanation. It's different what the Gemara says, but since it doesn't lead to any change in the bottom line halacha, I'm allowed to do this. She'ein ani roa hefresh, because I do not see a difference. I don't see a difference between explaining the Mishnah and explaining the Bible, the Torah. Where we permission is given to explain psukim, just like we see that many commentaries did this. If you look at Rashbam, for instance, if you look at Ibn Ezra, they often explain the, even in halachic matters, different than the Gemara. We'll get to later, we'll ask, well, what's the point? If the Gemara tells you this is what it means, then what good is an explanation of the Pasuk at odds with the Gemara? But we know they did it. And the Tosfos Yom Tov said there's no difference. Just like you can explain the Pesukim at odds with what the Torah Sheba'al Peh, or what the Gemara tells us is the halacha, al pi hapshat, so too I can explain the Mishnah al pi hapshat. And then he says, Ela shetzari shalo yachriya. And he says, we have to be careful not to make any halachic decisions based upon this, and to explain, before shum din shehe sosar das ba'ai gemara. We can't conclude practically, that is, I can't come up with a new halacha based upon my understanding. But if I don't do that, if it's just a theoretical explanation, the Tosfos Yom Tov says that this is okay and you can do this. Why would you want to do it, though? That's the question. What's the point? If the Gemara tells you this is the halacha, what's the point? Well, that's what we'll pick up with next class. I'll share with you the Vilna Gaon, the Netziv, and then a great dispute, a literary dispute, which has nothing to do with the reformers, completely in the Torah world, I would say, at least the religious world, on this very point. So this itself is not enough to cast Geiger in the camp of reformers, not at all. What it does, however, is show you that his mind was working and he was being provocative and he was really on the outer edges, because lots of people reject this Tosfos Yom Tov. But it's in the tradition, because the Tosfos Yom Tov says it, it's part of the tradition. The Vilna Gaon also has this, but it's provocative. So we see already in his 20s, he's thinking provocative, and wait till you see how provocative he will come. We will see that next week. Let me now take the comments and questions. I'll mark this where I am. Pick up next class. Let's see what we have here. Asher says, is a gun muktza? Or is it a klisha machtel isser that could be moved? That's why I took back what I said. I don't think it is muktzah. I took back what I said today. If you need it, But the point is that money could also be seen in the same way, perhaps, couldn't it? If it's going to save your life. I'm not sure. If we have experts in Hilchos Shabbos, we did see that the rabbis said, I can tell you that the people carry guns to shul all the time in America today. And no one thinks that that's a violation of halacha, as far as I know. We carry telephones also for Hatzalah and things like this, even if it might be far-fetched, but it could happen. So how far do you take this? 20 years ago, no one would carry a gun. We would say it's usher to carry a gun to shul on Shabbos. Even though 20 years ago, it's also theoretically possible anyone could break into our shul in Chutz Haaretz. So I don't know where you draw the line on this and when it's... Okay, I carried a gun on Shabbos. When I was in Israel, we went, the things we did in the 80s, we went to Kiryat Arba for Shabbos and we ate in Hebron, actual Hebron. And I remember I was because we had taken a week, we were in the army for a week. So that gave us the license, I guess, to carry a gun. We could do guard duty. So we could carry a gun if they gave it to us. Hadassah says, are Moshe accepted a Kew Garden Hills Erev? Kew Garden Hills is not the... It has to be Rosh Sarabim. Rabbi Jachter, Ramosha held 600,000. And for Ramosha, even in a car, it's still 600,000. That's enough to make it... New York is definitely Rosh Sarabim. If you, more details you can find in Rabbi Jachter's work. Also, Brooklyn was a big issue. Rav Moshe was opposed to the Flatbush Erev. Nissen says that one third of Romania is the former Hungarian province of Transylvania. However, real Romanian Jews are from a different culture. My grandmother was from Romania, I believe Bucharest. But you have some parts of Romania that are in Transylvania. Now we're in the Ukraine. Munkacs, for instance, is in the Ukraine right now, and Satmar went back and forth as well. MH says, as one Muslim told me, Allah is stronger than your Hashem, so he needs no day of rest. That's an interesting way to put it. It's a question, since you raised that, why do we... rest on Shabbos. Of course, there's two reasons. In the second Ten Commandments, it's in memory of, in commemoration, remembrance of the Exodus. But the first one is, at least a simple reading, you read it, it's Imitatio Dei. God rested, so we rest. But that's not how this Rishiyesh understands it. He doesn't, it's not that we're resting, not in commemoration of God resting, but in commemoration of the creation. Which God did. So, and he cites the Mor Nevuchim to make that point. Someone privately texts me that he thinks Rav Soloveitchik stopped saying Brich Shmei because of problematic wording. I never heard that before. And as far as I know, someone can testify in Maimonides Minyan, which they do a few interesting things thereof. Do they not say Brich Shmei? The problematic wording you're referring to would probably be Bar Elohim that appears in it, Sons of God, which... there was a great debate in Hadoar in the 60s over those words and how to translate it in the RCA Siddur, the Depola Pool Siddur, how it should be translated. And Rabbi Shavel has a piece there, and Paltiel Birnbaum has a whole piece there as well against how the RCA translated. I forgot what the Sola Pool translates it, but that's the expression. And there have been people who say that this is a Christian influence. I don't buy it, Christian influence. The word Elohim itself could refer to other things. This doesn't refer to God, but it is a strange wording, Bar Elohim. But I never heard that the Rav had an issue with that at all. And the Rav knew the Zohar, and the Rav would quote the Zohar and saw that as one of the holy works in the Jewish tradition. I'm not saying when he thought it was dated, but he thought he did not see it as out of the fold. So someone privately texted me, I have to look at the Minhagim of Simchas Torah and see how... what Rabbi Geiger, that is the Divrei Kehilos, his issues with Rav Hirsch, who instituted Hakafos and the language he uses against Hirsch. Yes, so because Geiger was not, he was a member of the general Kehila. The general Kehila was the last one, as far as I know, this Kehila, the old Frankfurt Kehila, not the Hirshian Kehila, was the last Kehila in the Ashkenazic world to bring in Lecha Dodi. Lecha Dodi is the last prayer really to achieve universal acceptance. And I don't think he even mentions it. I'm going to have to check now. He mentions it. But as far as I know, the Hirshian community accepted Lecha Dodi early on. But that community, the Grosskamainde community, held out. So I will also take a look at what he says about the Hakafos in Frankfurt. I know that I have a memoir. I think his name is Neuberger, maybe Willy Neuberger. I have a memoir, his memoirs of growing up in Frankfurt. And he says that what they would do with Simchas Torah is that two people, as I recall, would hold a Sefer Torah and they would do like a little dance. But Chas v'Shalom, that in old Frankfurt, you're going to have dancing like we had. That's not dignified. But I'll take a look at that. Nissen says the Hasidim traditionally respond Baruch Tiyah. So maybe that's where we got the Baruch Tiyahs. But I know growing up, I never heard, I went to shul every week, every day sometimes. People were always giving a shkoyach, and I never heard anyone say Baruch Tiyah. Maybe just where I live, my part of New Jersey, I didn't hear it. And other people will testify that they heard it growing up. But I never heard it growing up, just like other things I never heard growing up. But growing up, what did I hear? That was the tune. I didn't know the other tunes. So we knew there are certain things that that were done. And then we saw how things began to expand and difference. But I never heard Baruch Tiyah. Well, Justin says he also heard there was Soloveitchik didn't use any Zohar in Tefillah. So someone needs to, you got to confirm it, check it out. And Susanna says, heard from a teacher that Bar Ilan was an anti-Christian polemic. And says someone texts me that he and I are both of Romanian extraction. Okay, very nice. That's only one side. I'm more Russian. And finally, someone privately says that the dance that I referred to in the old Hirshian community on Simchas Torah is still done by one of the Piyutim. But they do have dancing in the Frankfurt community, I've been told. And so they've been influenced by the rest of us. Okay, with that, I thank you all for coming. Rabbi Kelman, who's on the road, is not able to say goodnight to everyone. So I will say goodnight and look forward, God willing, to see you all next week where we continue. Good night, everyone.
All right.